From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, southeastern Wisconsin businesses are expressing optimism for the second half of the year. We'll learn why. Later, downsizing in a good way, how one woman learned to live in an 84-square-foot house. What to expect from the screen adaptation of Jersey Boys.
It certainly has an avid audience of people who walked away really enjoying it, and will they come back for a second time in the theater? I don't know.
And the distinctive swing sounds, sort of Milwaukee's King Comets.
A lot of swing people would say we're not swing.
Right.
We don't do the traditional ching, 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 you know, that kind of sort of mellow or Benny Goodman big band swing. We're more of what we call jump swing.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. Economic analysts say many sectors of the national economy did better than expected last month, especially in areas such as employment. But the picture is a more nuanced one in Wisconsin, which has seen a generally slow economic recovery since 2008. But a survey by the magazine Milwaukee Biz Times suggests southeastern Wisconsin companies may be looking to the second half of 2014 with some optimism. Executive editor Steve Jagler is with us in the studio to relate what his magazine found. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Mitch.
Your article talks about a predicted rebound, one which ends up being reflected in some of the data we've already seen. But let's take a step back to start with. What kind of shape did the long winter and spring leave this region's economy in?
Well, on one hand, you can say winter's always cold, you know, in Wisconsin and for much of the United States. So it always has a chilling effect. But in particular, this past winter, we had one analyst document that there were 50,000 flights canceled over the winter this year. It was an unusually long, brutal, just a fierce winter that postponed a lot of purchasing decisions by both businesses and consumers. It really was a cold, wet blanket over the economy. And that has created a lot of pent-up demand, quite frankly, that I think we're going to see pick up in the second half of the year.
Well, and so what are the measures that you and other analysts looked at first to determine what recovery that there was had slowed down and now that things are more likely to pick up?
Well, when we do our reader dashboard survey, our readers tend to be the owners and managers of privately held companies. And we, in particular, go right for the jugular, the bottom line. We want to know what they are forecasting for revenues, profits, and hiring in the second half of the year. And the results came back strong that they are going to increase across the board on those lines in the second half of 2014.
They're expecting revenues to go up. They're expecting profits to go up. They're expecting the hiring to go up.
Exactly. And the latest survey of the members of the local Chamber of Commerce, the MMAC, also coincide with our dashboard results, projecting increases in revenues, profits, and hiring in the second half of the year.
That is not all that they're expecting to go up as well, though. They are also apparently expecting the cost of health care to go up. How are they reacting to that prospect?
I think for the most part, businesses and the labor force just expect that as a course of doing business, that healthcare costs will go up. I do understand, though, that the rate of increase of healthcare costs rising has slowed down significantly in the last couple of years.
And at the same time, they're talking about potentially passing those costs, in fact, some or all of those costs on to employees. They're also talking about wellness programs as well.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot more employers kind of being proactive with employee wellness programs. And even if they can't fully quantify a return on investment, I think they intuitively know that it does pay back to have a healthier workforce. And it also is a hiring perk, a perk for acquiring and keeping the best talent.
There's also an interesting contradiction that shows up, or maybe it's a cause and effect. We learn that banks are at their most generous with loans. It's the most generous they've been since the recovery began. But at the same time, demand is very low for lending. What's going on there? Is lending something that typically trails behind other economic indicators?
Yeah, what comes first, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The demand for the money or the money and meets the demand. I guess it's really a never-ending cycle. I think we'll have to keep an eye on that in the second half of the year. The banks I speak to say that they have money to lend for commercial businesses. I think there is still some hesitancy among employers to add permanent positions because they were so blindsided by the Great Recession that it's kind of a fool me once kind of deal. They don't want to get blindsided again, and they are not adding to their staff until they absolutely have no other choice.
You also write about the possibility that some are looking at expanding their current facility or moving to new facilities. How common is that in the data that you collected?
I wouldn't say it's back to pre-recession levels by any means in terms of business expansion or moves. But we are seeing an uptick in it. It certainly is better than it was 2 years ago.
We've heard encouraging forecasts in the past, which haven't necessarily fully come to fruition. Have you seen expectations tempered in recent years by the pace of the recovery?
Our numbers this year are remarkably stronger than they were at the midpoint last year. I'm confident that nationally, we're going to see a significant expansion in GDP, and certainly the stock market is reflecting that. The Dow pierced the 17,000 mark for the first time last month, and the economy added 288,000 jobs in June. The unemployment rate fell to 6.1%, its lowest rate since September of 2008. We fully expect the pace of recovery to pick up in the second half of the year.
Well, and it's interesting because these national numbers came out just after the issue of the magazine came out. And it's nice to see that, you know, some of the forecast is already being reflected in reality. Would you see southeastern Wisconsin in a similar place to the rest of the country?
That's kind of a loaded question if you tie in the political aspects of it. Wisconsin's private sector job growth is trailing the neighboring states. Now, as to why that is, I'll leave it to other political pundits to wrestle with that or assess blame for that. I like to stick to the data and let the political stuff fall where it may. Wisconsin is improving. The unemployment rate in Wisconsin is 5.7%, down from 5.8%. And our unemployment rate has always been below the national rate. So that part of the glass is half full. The part that is half empty is that Wisconsin's rate of private sector job growth has not kept up with the neighboring states.
On another note, you also survey companies about their marketing work, things like marketing itself, but also areas like app development and social media strategy. How does that fit in with the dashboard survey?
That's kind of a periphery along the edges that we were just curious about. We'll have to watch those numbers over time. Right now, I think a lot of companies are just kind of dabbling in the whole social media thing without a kind of a defined strategy. I think most businesses are still trying to figure out all that and as it relates to their customers and their employees.
As we head into the second half of the year, what indicator do you think we should look at most closely?
The bottom line is jobs, isn't it? That's the most real world impact. But I think that jobs number is going to stem directly up or down based on the revenues and the profits. If the revenues and the profits are strong and employers become fully confident that they're going to have more customers, then they're going to hire more people. All in companies, and I'm sure even in the nonprofit sector, in public radio, we've all had to do more with less. We've just had to learn how to do more with less. And at some point, once the pace picks up enough, people are going to have to start hiring again and add more staff to meet the demand. And I think we are turning a corner in that realm right now.
Well, and to that end, I need to go vacuum my floor.
There you go.
Steve Jagler, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Steve Jagler is executive editor of the magazine Milwaukee Biz Times. The results of the magazine's mid-year dashboard survey are in the current issue, and there is a link from WUWM.com/likeeffect. Economic recovery aside, many of us want to downsize and declutter our lives. But could you fit your life into an 84-square-foot house? We'll meet one woman who did when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. 10 years ago, Dee Williams was a busy professional and homeowner living in Portland, Oregon. When she experienced and recovered from a near-death experience, Williams took stock, scaled back, and built, with help from her friends, an 84-square-foot house. 84. Today, Williams helps others explore the idea of going small through a company she co-owns called Portland Alternative Dwellings, and she's written a book called The Big Tiny, a built-it-myself memoir. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz caught up with her by phone in May while Williams took her book on the road. Williams described just how different life was before her Big Tiny transformation.
This was 10 years ago. I lived in a big three-bedroom, 1,500 square foot house in Portland, Oregon. And, you know, I was slaving away at my job. I worked full-time as a hazardous waste inspector and worked a lot to make my mortgage and pay my utility bills, and spent most of my time. It kind of shifted from being footloose and fancy-free before I owned this big bungalow to being the kind of person that would stay home on the weekend to mow the grass and fix the roof and repaint the living room antique white. You know, I was spending all my time and money on this big house and then landed in the hospital. And all of a sudden, how I was spending my time didn't make sense anymore. I remember getting home from the hospital and I sitting in my living room and just looking around at the stuff that I had in my life. And it just didn't make sense anymore. And a couple weeks later, I read an article about a guy who had built a little house, and for some reason, it just clicked for me. It was like, I can get out from under my debt. I can all of a sudden, maybe I could work part-time at my job and do the things that I really wanted to do before, you know, I kick the bucket.
So just to clarify, you were diagnosed with a heart condition. That was a blow.
It was really weird. You know, I was very active. I was a runner and a climber. You know, I'm one of those fidgety kind of people. Getting diagnosed with congestive heart failure, which had a really horrible prognosis of like 1 to 3 years, 1 to 5 years. All of a sudden, it was like, I'm not going to be able to go running when I want to go running. It was scary. You know, it was very challenging to try to figure out how to make sense of things right after I got diagnosed.
Can you describe the process? What led ultimately to the construction of your tiny house?
Well, I read this article and I was like, I could do that. I could do it. And, you know, I grew up building things. I studied architectural engineering. I loved operating power tools. I had a lot of friends who were carpenters. And so, you know, the idea of building a little house completely captivated my imagination. It was something that I thought I could do. And it was a great focus away from being fearful about my health and feeling kind of like a foreigner inside my own body. And it was awesome. It took me 3 months and $10,000. And at the other end of it, I had decided to sell my big house and move into this little tiny house and call it home.
So that being 84 square feet.
84 square feet, yeah. It's the size of my mom and dad's pantry.
So are you a very small person? I don't mean as a human. I don't mean at your spirit. I mean your physical persona.
Yeah, I'm 5'5", and I'm a tiny person. I built the house kind of proportionally to fit me, so the kitchen counters fit my body, and the house definitely was built around my body, but it's accommodating to my tallest, biggest friends.
I've read that you can now list your belongings on one sheet of paper. Describe freeing yourself of all of those possessions. Couldn't have been easy all the time.
Yeah, you know, the process of culling through my stuff in my big house was horrible. I mean, I don't want to gloss over the challenge. I mean, there's the easy stuff to get rid of, you know, your tchotchkes in the basement that you don't really look at anymore. But then there were the harder things that just couldn't fit. And an example for me was the artwork that I had up on the walls. You know, some of it was stuff that I had done. There was, you know, my friends are artists and, you know, just amazing pieces of art, and I didn't know what to do with it. So I ended up handing things off to friends with the condition that I could come visit it, you know. And it was grueling to go through and find good homes for things and to also let go. You know, I had a box of stuff up in the attic of, you know, old love letters and wedding announcement and things like that that really represented my past. And so giving myself permission to let go of my past was a part of me being able to kind of step forward into my new life.
So nuts and bolts, how do you handle water and electricity?
Well, I have a big 240-watt solar electric system that runs all my gadgets, so I'm off the grid. And then for water, I pull water from a nearby tap and jug it into the house. I have a composting toilet, and I shower either at work or at the gym or at my friend's house. And I think you know, most people that I talk to, the shower is where the deal kind of falls apart. You know, and most of the folks that I know, there are lots and lots of people who are building tiny houses now, similar to mine. But you know, most of them have some sort of a water hookup so that they can kind of have a normal, you know, flushing toilet and shower.
Do you imagine any modifications in your future?
You know, as I've aged in place, the thing that has ended up being the challenge for me, I have a 7-foot ladder to get into the sleeping loft. And, you know, as I fell out of the loft a couple years ago and broke my butt, I essentially broke my sacrum. And, you know, I don't know if that ladder is going to work forever for me as I teeter into old age. Knock on wood, I hope I get to be old enough that the ladder doesn't work.
So that's really your primary focus, is getting up there aspect, not water or other modifications.
No, you know, over time, I mean, most of the world lives without water. And so, yes, sometimes it's inconvenient. And yes, sometimes I grouse about, like, whose idea was it to live without running water? Give myself a hard time for that, but those ideas are passing, because you know, right up against my own grousing about what I don't have, I can very easily see that I have a lot more than most people in the world. Most people, you know, don't get to sit around inside that sense of gratitude, and or they bump into it every once in a while. And so I really do try, like when I'm feeling particularly bitter about not having running water, I really do try to spin it a little bit and get through it. And, you know, and then you wake up the next day and everything's fine.
I realize you have a story to tell, but when did the idea of, hey, I'm going to do a book, when did that start to form in your head?
You know, a couple years ago, a very good friend of mine, Tammy Strobel, was working on writing a book, and it looked like the writing process for her was something that she got a lot out of. And I was still, you know, trying to articulate what it was about my little house that was making me so happy. I mean, I felt satisfied with my life in a way that I hadn't when I lived in my big house. And I couldn't quite put my finger on why. And through the writing process, and by, again, kind of playing anthropologist with myself and coming up, trying to chronicle what my day in and day out is like, I bumped into the idea that I think the reason I feel more satisfied is because I lean into my natural community and my neighbors differently than I used to. I mean, I really see, you know, I wake up in the morning, I have this big skylight over my bed, and from my first waking moment, I get invited outside visually to whatever it's doing outside, raining, snowing, which looks like, you know, a styrofoam cooler sitting on your window, or a beautiful sunny day. So you can't see that view every morning and not have it change you.
So do you imagine you might pass your first big tiny house on and build another, or you're sticking with this baby?
I'm sticking with this one, but I have definitely, you know, I got the bug while I was building mine. I love building, and I love designing. And so, you know, the fortunate thing is that I've been able, I started this company called Portland Alternative Dwellings, and a lot of what we do is, you know, focus on the do-it-yourselfers out there. There are lots of people that want to take on building, or they want to take a look at simplifying their life somehow. So we offer workshops, we offer plans and books and stuff like that. And more than anything else, I think it's kind of a one-part how-to that we offer, and the two parts why not. You know, we really try to encourage people to examine, you know, what brings them joy, and do that in a way that, you know, is fun.
Would you have thought about the idea of sustainable living before your life changed, and has your definition for yourself changed?
Well, I mean, I studied, you know, my master's work was in environmental studies, so I think I've always been an outdoor person, and I've always called myself an environmentalist. But, you know, I was working so hard and on a certain track. You know, when you own a house, you kind of have to do certain things, like buy goopy, nasty stuff to seal the leak in the roof, and spend your time in certain ways that doesn't give you time and money to volunteer, you know, to help the local group trying to pull invasive ivy out of the watershed, you know. So I think I was an environmentalist, and I recycled, you know, and I rode my bike sometimes, you know. But deciding to build my little house and step away from, you know, my big house gave me an opportunity to live differently. So, and by that, it wasn't just time and money. It was also just recognizing that I am a part of an amazing community. You know, I live in one of the most beautiful places on earth, and I see that differently than I used to. And I see, you know, my community connections differently. I want the local food co-op to thrive, because I walk down there every other day because I don't have a big pantry. You know, it is my pantry. And so this sense of sustainability and what is sustainability has changed for me, in part because I've come to see how interrelated everything is. And I still have a lot of work to do on myself. You know, I'm flying all over the country for this book tour, and we all know that's not sustainable. And I, you know, humbly see, you know, there's still stuff that I can do different.
Dee Williams is the co-owner of Portland Alternative Dwellings and author of The Big Tiny, a Built-It-Myself memoir. She spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz in an interview which first aired in May. You'll find images of Williams' 84-square-foot dwelling at WUWM.com/lakeeffect. Millions of people love the stage musical Jersey Boys, but will they love the on-screen version? We'll see what our film contributor thinks when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
My eyes are Georgia. Oh, I never laid a hand on you. My eyes are Georgia.
More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Blockbuster Broadway musicals have often been adapted to the big screen. The movie version has sometimes had the same success as the stage run, sometimes not. The latest film adaptation of a Broadway musical is attracting a lot of attention, as much for its director as for the music itself. Lake Effect film contributor Dave Lurson chats with our Dan Harmon about the challenges and successes of a movie version of Jersey Boys.
A Broadway musical based on a string of hits by a singing group popular with baby boomers is a bankable idea. But who would have wagered that a production driven by the hits of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons would win four Tonys and launch one of the century's longest theatrical runs? Reversing the trend for Broadway to emulate Hollywood, Motion Pictures came calling to Jersey Boys in the form of Clint Eastwood, who directs the much-anticipated movie version intended as a summer blockbuster whose heroes would rather sing than save the world.
Is that a tough road right there, just trying to create a movie that's going to equal the success of the stage production?
Well, the scale of a Hollywood success versus a Broadway success, they are totally different things. A production that does really well on Broadway would be considered probably a failure, you know, from Hollywood blockbuster standards, so you have to look at it that way. But, yeah, I mean, given the enormous popularity of Jersey Boys, there are, you know, anticipations that people in the industry had. And I haven't actually checked on the latest box office. I think that the movie has done fairly well. It's not going to go down as one of the top sellers of all time. But, it certainly has an avid audience of people who walked away really enjoying it. And will they come back for a second time in the theater? I don't know. A few of them might, but I think the movie will have a long afterlife on Netflix and DVD.
Well, we've both seen it. What is your opinion of it?
Well, a couple of things. I'm never entirely satisfied with biographical movies of any kind. And as the author of three published biographies, I recognize the problem. I mean, even if you have 300 or 400 pages in a book to work with, you're always going to have a problem reducing the complexity of anyone's life, all the contradictions, the digressions, getting the context of the time they lived in and the issues they faced. It's very hard to condense this in a meaningful way, even in a book. Now, with a movie, you have 2 hours, basically, to do all of this, and you have to do an awful lot of trimming and cutting and tailoring to make it fit. A miniseries would be really a much better medium for biographies of anybody who, you know, had a significant long-term career or impact on the world. Well, given all of that, Jersey Boys certainly simplifies the four-season story quite a bit. It falls into a formula for these kinds of movies. You have, you know, the kids on the street, you know, kind of they're facing all kinds of hurdles in life. They triumph, but then they face another set of problems, whether drugs, money, rival band members, and all of the above. And then in the final act, they triumph. They get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, or they have a comeback tour, or something like that happens with them. And so the movie follows that formula. That being said, though, I was entertained by it. I thought that it moved along pretty well, unlike many other movies I've seen lately that clock in at just over 2 hours. I didn't begrudge every second beyond the two-hour point. So it was fine. I mean, the other thing to say about this is that I really believe that the audience, the primary audience for Jersey Boys, are people who grew up with that music. And I'm just a little bit too young. I missed the cutoff point for it. So for me, the Four Seasons would have been my older sister's group if I had had an older sister. I mean, they were not relevant to me in my, you know, formative years. But I know a great many people who are a little bit older than me who just, you know, loved the movie, were looking forward to it. Some of them saw the stage production in Chicago or wherever it came. And, that is the main audience for it. And in talking to those people, they were not disappointed.
I am not of that audience, and I just wanted to see it because it looked interesting, and, you know, that's what's not to like if you like that music. So it seems to me that in order for it to be a blockbuster, it has to appeal to more than just that audience. And did they have to dilute it in any way to make it more appealing to people that aren't of that generation?
Well, I don't know that they did that. And yes, that would certainly be the commercial challenge of the movie. How do you either market it to be of interest to people who didn't grow up with that music, or how do you reshape the story in some way? I don't think that they reshaped the story, you know, to do that. How the marketing, I can't really speak to that. And again, I no doubt there are people younger than me or of my own era who went to see the movie and enjoyed it. Might be an outing for your parents in some cases, or you know, whatever. Maybe you're kind of a buff of 50s, 60s pop music, or maybe you love Broadway musicals. I mean, a lot of, you know, 20-somethings, teenagers love Broadway musicals, and I'm sure that people of that inclination would go to see this and find something there. So it's not just limited to the early 1960s pop music crowd, but that is very important. I mean, any musical biographical picture, the primary audience for it are the people who really relate to that form of music. I think goes without saying. So the marketing challenge is to think, you know, one step beyond that, and how do you draw other people into it?
Well, the theater was sprinkled with 20-somethings.
Good.
Yeah. Well, so, all right. Yeah,
musical fans, perhaps.
Perhaps. Or they were dragged there by their partner. I have no idea what, you know, who knows?
You should have done a survey.
Well, what do you think that this movie didn't do so well?
Well, what it didn't do so well, which is what really almost any movie of this kind I've ever seen doesn't do so well, it's the complexity of the story. In reality, the Four Seasons, you know, put out several records on small labels before the big break that came with the producer that they encountered about when would it be halfway through the movie. Things of that kind, I guess. There just, you know, was a lot more going on, you know, around them and in terms of their career than the movie could possibly contain. But many of the main, I mean, was it true to the spirit of what happened? And there I would say, yes, it was. They really did name themselves after a lounge in New Jersey, not after the Vivaldi, you know, composition. I of course, didn't live in New Jersey during the 1950s, but, you know, the portrayal of the time and place certainly is what I think most of us imagine it must have been like to be there. And, you know, one of the assets of this movie is the characters you see singing really are singing. And in fact, many of the Broadway cast members reprised their roles in the movie. So, you know, musically, it's dynamic. And the story, well, and Clint Eastwood and his screenwriters expanded the story a bit from what was told on Broadway. Broadway, you know, kept more to the music with some asides to the audience, I guess. And here, because it's a 2-hour or some movie, Clint Eastwood felt that there was some need to go a little bit, a step beyond that, fill in some of the details, which he did. And yeah, I mean, I'm in terms of what a movie like this can do, I'm satisfied by it.
Well, something else I thought it did well was show the connection with the underworld, mm-hmm. if you will, and then also illustrated how unpleasant the music / record industry was.
Yes,
at the time.
That's accurate. I mean, the mafia had a great role to play in the music industry in Milwaukee too. As much as there was a music industry here, or you know, at the time, the mob had a hand in it, and certainly all the more so in places like the East Coast, where people could imagine a more realistic springboard from singing in the local bar or club to a recording contract. So all that is true. I mean, it mythologizes the role of the benign, you know, mafia don, you know, as a character in here. And again, I don't know how much of that is based on the true story of the Four Seasons, but it's the kind of thing that audience members would like to believe, that there was a benign mafia don who was sentimental about them and helped them out when times got hard. So is that truthful? Don't know.
Something else, I guess, another thing I thought that it did well was, at least this might be completely nostalgic for a time I was never around for, but it seems like, you know, we get a lot of CDs sent to us, and I think there's a lot of mediocrity mm-hmm. in the music industry, if I can put it nicely, but then it just seemed like you didn't get anywhere unless you actually did have talent, because someone had to really think they were going to make money off of you in order for you to get a recording contract.
Yeah, one of the things that maybe in parallel to what you're saying, what struck me is, of course, the Four Seasons really had to sing well. I mean, singing groups, you know, had to sing well. Songwriters were expected to write well. I mean, Saying this, though, I mean, there was an awful lot of mediocre music being released and produced at that time. We just wouldn't ever make a movie out of any of those groups, probably, because they either didn't make an impact or nobody would like them anymore. But certainly the music that rose to the top at that time, in most cases, even if you don't like it, you would have to look at that, listen to it, and say, yeah, you know, I can appreciate that there was a level of actual human talent that went in here. It wasn't just all click track percussion and laptop electronics and Pro Tools, and we'll click and drag the guitar part from here to there. I mean, people really recorded these things pretty much in live time. And yeah, there was overdubbing. You could retake, you know, a flubbed note. I mean, all of that was going on already at that point to some extent. But the human factor was not overwhelmed by the technology at that point. That would happen maybe starting in the 1970s. I think you can begin to see that decline.
So this is something you recommend people see if you're looking for some
summer
fun.
If you have any remote interest in Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, yes, definitely you should see it. And maybe even if you don't, it's certainly, I found, to be an entertaining way of spending 2 hours and 14 minutes.
Yeah, something a little different for the summer, I guess.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express weekly newspaper, author of its I Hate Hollywood blog, and our regular film contributor. He spoke with Dan Harmon about the screen version of Jersey Boys. If Frankie Valli's music appeals across generations, the same holds true for swing bands as well. We'll meet a Milwaukee band with a devoted following of people who were born well after the heyday of Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller. That's when we return on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. You never know what music you might find at a rummage sale or an antique store or even in your grandparents' attic. In the case of Milwaukee's King Comets, the jump swing music they perform is inspired by songs they happen across in ways kind of like those. The band has entertained and accompanied swing dancers in southeastern Wisconsin for more than a decade. It features Steve Braun, Michael Fricka, John Staffis, and Dennis Tomaszek, who all recently joined Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson in the studio.
Comets, welcome to WWM.
Thanks for having us, Eleanor.
The traditional band tends to have about 15 musicians, but there are only four of you. Why did you choose this format?
It's easier.
We make more money that way.
Exactly. It's easier to get in the clown car.
What are the pros and cons behind having just four musicians?
Well, it's easier to schedule a rehearsal, even though that's still impossible.
What's a rehearsal?
But, this makes, I think, we're more cohesive that way because we can hear each other and really, you know, listen and stuff. But there's parts that we can't cover and we just have to work around that.
Yeah, when you're looking at orchestral arrangements or even arrangements for 6-piece, 8-piece, sometimes stuff just has to either be thrown out or else we have to really cut back on it. We also each pretty much do double duty for vocals, so it's just the way it is. We have to play our instrument and sing at the same time, and we've gotten kind of good at it.
It's hard to do on saxophone.
It is. I know. Well, you do the dancing.
That's true.
Because I saw on your website that there's also screaming involved with you guys.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. A lot of screaming.
That's my job.
Yeah, it's Steve's job.
How do you get such great volume out of four musicians?
You know, a lot of it is that we do, a lot of the stuff we play is like 40s, and I think they used to call it call and response. So one guy will say one thing, and you know the other guys will holler back at him depending upon, like, Louis Jordan stuff or Louis Prima stuff. We love that kind of stuff. So we got a big sound, and that's what a lot of people say. You know, for four pieces, you got a big sound.
Yep. We also do a lot of egging on. So if some guy's doing well, woo, and if some guy's doing bad, and that kind of thing keeps us going, keeps us energized.
We still have a lot of energy, too, for the youngsters that we are.
When did you guys start?
1999. It's our 15th year.
Wow, you guys are old.
I met Steve when I was 8, and we started right away.
Yep.
So, you know, we're still going.
Are you guys all from the Milwaukee area, or where are you from?
I live up near Fond du Lac now. But, yeah, we're basically all from the Milwaukee area.
I saw that Steve actually played around in Minneapolis for a while. Did you have any collaboration or jam sessions with Brian Setzer?
No, Michael actually played.
Well, I met him a couple times. Yep. And when he came to town, I kind of got in his face. I knew where he was staying, and I met him, I think, twice, and we just talked. You know, he's just a nice guy. He's just a real sweet guy, you know, so.
You were talking a little bit about your styles of swing, about a 1940s era. So how would you define, really, your style of swing? Are you more rockabilly? Are you older, 1930s, Benny Goodman? Where do you guys, are you guys on the scale here?
A lot of swing people would say we're not swing.
Right.
We don't do the traditional ching, 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 you know, that kind of sort of mellower Benny Goodman big band swing. We're more of what we call jump swing. Around the time of the war, of course, it got to be really hard to get 30 musicians together. And clubs didn't have the money also to pay for it. So a lot of what was called jump swing groups came up where they were 5, 6, 7 pieces, which for back then was smaller, just because it was easier to get gigs that way and to find enough musicians. And I think we sort of model ourselves more after that. But then we also do a lot of stuff from the 50s with the rockabilly kind of thing, which tended to be smaller groups. So
And then the coasters or the platters, because we have the vocals. We can do some really fun harmony stuff too. And I think we always look forward to playing live gigs because we always look forward to each other messing up on stage. And then we all and we don't. We just have fun with it. And people, I think people like the fact that we're having a ball, you know.
So it's pretty improvisatory.
Yeah, sometimes a little too much. Or not planned improvisation, let's put it that way.
Are you trained musicians then as well?
Those three are.
I actually have a music degree, which doesn't really affect me in this band at all.
Ouch.
Thankfully. Actually, I mean, that's okay with me. It's the bands I've tended to play in have been more towards the pop or rock or American roots style than the classical, even jazz styles, which is fine because it leaves me more open to do things and experiment and mess around.
What bands inspired you? Because you mentioned Louis Prima. What other bands inspire you with your music?
Well, let me tell you.
Ooh.
I knew we'd get that question. We'd walk in here and blank, so I wrote him down. So Louis Jordan is what we call the godfather or the father of rock and roll. He started out with a small combo where originally he had a big band, and as he got into the 50s, he shrunk it down. But Louis Jordan is really the father of rock and roll. So we do a lot of his stuff, love it. Louis Prima, you might know him for Oh Marie and Jump Jive and Whale. We do some of his stuff. But then we just bounce off into rock and roll like Eddie Cochran, Gene Vincent, some doo-wop with the Coasters, Huey Piano Smith and the Clowns, stuff like that, a little Ray Charles. We go all over the map. It's really just go listen to the old 45s, find one you really like that we think we can handle. We learn it. If everybody likes it, we'll learn it.
Yeah.
And a lot of times our tunes are so obscure, people think, is that an original? It's like, no, actually, that isn't. And then some of our originals, people think somebody else must have wrote them because they can't believe that we would come up with them.
Throw that trash out. No, that's one of ours. Still throw it out.
When I go to swing dances, I find that most of the crowd is about 30 or younger. Why do you think swing dancing is so popular or cool with millennials?
Because they can still move their joints.
Oh, no, we just had an old couple. The man passed away, and him and his wife had been coming to our gigs forever, and they had all the moves. I think, you know, we get a lot of people our age at gigs who are a couple years older than 30, you know, and it's just, I think they like the energy, and they like the exercise.
Yes,
you know?
It's much more, the exercise is a lot higher. They have to also learn the moves. It's not so freestyle, and yet then they incorporate them together. It's just...
Right. I think the partner thing, it's one of the few styles of dancing still where you're doing it with a partner as opposed to just sort of, you know, going out on the dance floor and getting your freak on type of thing.
Definitely.
They still use that term, the kids these days?
Oh, yes. Groovy, yes. Dennis, groovy.
Far out.
Yes. And also, I mean, you see them do some of these moves, and as we said, you know, flipping people over their heads and between their legs and stuff. It's incredible to watch it, and just so much more challenging for a certain group of people to be able to pull that off and pull it off well. I always say when somebody says, can I do that kind of dancing? I say, come down and you get a great dancer as your partner and they're happy to switch off between people, they'll make you look good. A good dancer makes their partner look good.
Plus, they inspire us a lot. I mean, it really adds energy to see all these people out there dancing and having a great time. And not just sort of the – we've played some that are more formal concert settings, and for us it's sort of like – okay, you can stop looking at us now.
Yeah. How many more charts do I have?
Mm-hmm.
So in your opinion, what is the difference between pre-World War II swing to post-World War II swing, and why do you seem to prefer the post-World War II swing music?
It's really the numbers, the size, and as you got into post-World War II, the difference between white music and black music started to merge, mm-hmm. and you started getting what became rock and roll. And that's also when you started to minimize the number of people in the band.
Yeah, and then I think, you know, with the introduction of the electric guitar around World War II, obviously that amped up, I think, the energy level a little bit. As we said, Steve's quite an energetic drummer, and he really drives us. You know, he's got that punk background. So.
That's right.
Yeah. I think that's also part of it, is we're trying to capture that energy that was around in the late 40s, early 50s.
You just recently released your second album, Pull That String. What can we expect to hear from that CD?
Going into any song on there. Wait, I don't have it in front of me. I can't say that. We also keep moving forward and just we'll write original songs, but we'll also learn cover tunes, and we'll just keep throwing new ones in there all the time. So what's a common one? Sweet Dreams Are Made of This, the Eurythmics tune. We did a jump swing version of that.
Really?
Yes.
Very cool.
Sweet dreams are made of these, and who am I to disagree? Travel the world, the seven seas, everybody's looking for something. Sweet dreams are made of these, and who am I to disagree? Travel the world and the seven seas, everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you, and some of them want to get used by you.
How does that happen?
Oh, Johnny brings in some kooky stuff, and he goes, we should try this because it'll work. And we all go, really? And then we run through it, and we go, yeah, this is great. This is going to work this way.
Yeah.
You know, so.
It's a lot of just listening to what's out there and going, you know, mashups are a lot more in style these days, where people take an old song and just completely wipe it and start over. And you can recognize it. So you see people out there like, why do I know this song? I'm so happy. Why am I singing along? I don't know. And it's because we've changed it so much, but yet they still remember the lyrics and the general layout. Very enjoyable for them.
And oftentimes we change songs, as we said, because we have to. You know, they have a big horn section, and there's just me. Or, you know, well, we don't have those three extra guitars, so we just work it out so it works for four piece.
So you don't collaborate with any other swing groups in town?
We'll play with them, sure, mm-hmm. but it's very rare that we'll, you know, bring band members up on stage to join us.
We have in the past.
Yeah. And even on that CD, we have Tyler Treband and John Simons came in and did a little horn section on a song called No, 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 No. And it was great because we added like a little Dixieland thing on that song. Just having them in there, it was great.
What's coming up next? Working towards another CD or?
We're always working towards another
CD.
The nice thing is, we've got the material.
It just takes time, you know, getting us all together. I think John is the youngest cat in the band, and he's got three kids under
70.
And so, you know, his hands are full most of the time, and he's the recording whiz.
We do record all of our live shows, and I'll send the guys copies and say, hey, take a listen to this, see if this is anything good. Maybe we should release some of this live. That hasn't happened yet, but we like listening to it, and it's a great way to find out when you're making mistakes. Right, Mike?
Because John and Steve and Dennis are like constantly making mistakes.
And then we've also found, too, that we like to play songs out live first, because even when you write a song, if you take it in the studio right away, it doesn't really grow. And even the songs we've recorded have changed over the years as you play them live, and they start to pick up a different energy. And so it's nice to experiment with them live and go, okay, that worked or that didn't work, you know. And then when you go in to record, you have a little more idea of what you want.
What advice would you give to aspiring swing band musicians, and who would you recommend that they listen to?
Oh, wow. You know, you just have to go dig up stuff. The easiest way is on YouTube, kind of start looking at stuff, then see what it references on the side. We have found so many great tunes just by hunting for one artist and looking for another. There's a lot of great compilations for Jump Swing that are out there. You just have to start searching.
Yeah, there's a lot of great obscure stuff that you've never heard, or but it's incredible, but it never got out to the general public, especially a lot of the black music, like Johnny was saying. It just, never got played. And there was a lot of regional music in the old days where maybe it was only in Philadelphia or only in Detroit. Nowadays, you can find all that stuff on YouTube, which
is great. How many people these days actually still listen to the Coasters and the Five Keys or the song She's the Most? I'm still trying to remember who that is. But all these old artists that we just never got to hear growing up because we didn't have that on the radio, and Lord knows you couldn't find it barely in the stores. So
you got turned on to it secondhand. Yeah. So when I was a kid, I listened to the Beatles, and I went, oh, they didn't write this. Who wrote it? And you go, oh, R. Penniman, which was Little Richard. And then Little Richard would go, you got to listen to
Chuck Berry.
Yeah, or, and Little Richard turned me on to Caledonia.
Yep.
So it's you go back, and then they send you back even further, and it's fun because, there's so much stuff you haven't heard. And when you do, you get excited because you go, hey, this is a new tune.
Can't believe that there's so much old stuff out there you've never heard before, and you can't believe that people aren't listening to it right now.
Right. And then there's even newer bands. I mean, you can go back to some of the punk stuff or the 80s. In fact, we're working on a tune the Blasters did. But then we found out that this is actually an old song from the early 60s by somebody that I still don't know who it is.
Little Willie John.
There you go. But, that kind of stuff. And then, just listening to everything and trying to incorporate it, I think, is a key, too, if you're coming up as a musician. Listen to everything you can.
Yep.
Take what you like and
throw the rest away.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's why you're the kings.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. I'll take that.
All right, King Comets, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to seeing you at one of your gigs.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Ellen.
Bye.
The King Comets are Steve Braun, Michael Frickett, John Steffes, and Dennis Tomaszek. They joined Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson in the studio recently. The King Comets play at Bastille Days this Friday, July 11th at 7 p.m. on the Beaux Arts stage. That's all for the Thursday edition of Lake Effects. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be able to tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 and weekend afternoons at 3 for Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Coming your way at noon, it's Here and Now from WBUR and NPR in Boston. Right now, though, it's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next. Ready.